This is Dr. Shannon M. Clark with A Doctor Delivers Podcast, and today I am discussing gay, lesbian, and transgender family building with REI specialist Dr. Sarah Mukowski. Have a listen. This is Dr. Sarah Mukowski with Dallas IVF in Dallas, Texas. She is a reproductive endocrinology and infertility specialist. We are going to talk today specifically about gay, lesbian, and transgender family building, with some special considerations for the transgender individuals, obviously, and we'll talk about that as we go along. It's very important to talk about because it's becoming more and more talked about, actually. It's becoming more, there was just an individual, follow him on Instagram, who just shared his story about giving birth as a transgender male, which got a lot of attention and was very popular, and I really applaud him sharing his story. Do you have a lot of patients for gay, lesbian, and transgender family building?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. Obviously, there's going to need to be some degree of help in that mm-hmm. community. And so yes. We're certainly the right people to come to in order to provide that help for growing families.
So let's start off the top. This is one I always send all of my, all the people that are going to do this, these types of things with me, an outline. But I just want to start off with the last question first. What should someone who is in the LGBTQIA plus community look for in a fertility center? Like, how do they choose? How do they know if their fertility specialist is versed in their special considerations and special needs as being someone from that population? What should they look for?
Absolutely. Well, I think obviously the most places I think where people start, if it's not going to be word of mouth, where they're already aware of somebody mm-hmm. who's an ally or who's LGBTQ friendly, is going to be a website, right? So you want to be kind of aware of what it is you're looking at. Do we have a really inclusive population on the website? Is there a separate tab for LGBTQ family building, that sort of thing? And then dig into bios more, you know, in depth. If you want to look for things like Instagram and that sort of thing, yeah. to be able to have a better idea as to what providers are out there. And there are a couple of other different networks available too, depending on your region. I know that have essentially lists of physicians in different specialties that have been found to be LGBTQ friendly.
Yeah, and you could also interview. Do you ever have somebody just come and interview you to see if you're a right fit for them?
Absolutely, but I certainly wouldn't leave that to just the LGBTQ community.
I think of course. Yeah, I didn't interview because my REI was my friend, but I didn't know how often that was done, that where they come and kind of had the initial visit just to see if they're a good match. I think that's obviously very, very important in anyone who's seeking assisted reproductive technology help. So
I agree.
So let's start from the top. And this is regarding fertility care for lesbians, couples with two egg providers, and a single parent by choice. Now, mm-hmm. I want to make sure that we acknowledge a single parent by choice because it is a large population. And I've got a lot of feedback from people who say that they didn't feel that it was a little bit of a harder road to navigate when they were doing it on their own. So I want to make sure that if you think of any specific considerations for those individuals, to just bring it up as we go along for any of these situations that we talk about.
Sure.
So first of all, for couples with two egg providers or a single person by choice, how do they go about choosing a sperm donor, getting a sperm donor? What is that process like?
So number one, I would say in the state of Texas, you want to make sure that you're at least doing that through a physician's office, because there are very specific laws in place regarding what defines a sperm donor. Okay. And one of those pieces is having the physician as part of kind of the process. But from there, there's obviously kind of the known donor options or commercially available donor options. And even amongst the commercially available donor options, there's a lot of wide variety as to what's available. And you had kind of touched on in your outline too, kind of mm-hmm. what sort of things are there as far as getting to know that donor. Is it just kind of a written bio? Is it just pictures? Is it a combination of both? Are you hearing their voice? Is there any potential for them to contact your child or for your child to have contact with them at some point in the future? I know I asked this question on my Instagram a while ago as to what was important to somebody who chose a sperm donor, and got everything from kind of things that you would almost anticipate, right? Things that were genetics that were similar to either intended parent or had other things that were, you know, important to them from a personality perspective. But I thought the most interesting response was, I picked somebody who I'd want to have dinner with, right? Somebody you'd really want to get to know better, right? If that's going to be a big part of your family.
Yeah, I think it's very personal. You know, people ask me all the time, I used an egg donor or had a donor egg pregnancy, you know, what were my criteria? My criteria are actually pretty simple. I think you could get as involved as you want when picking a sperm donor. I'm sure mm-hmm. the same as for an egg donor, or you can be as not involved as you want. It depends on what you're looking for. I know that I'm sure sperm donor registries are the same, that you kind of have a drop down menu of the different criteria that you want. And same thing for donor egg. The one thing I do want to ask regarding sperm donors, though, we do have something called a donor egg registry where I could go and see if there are any other children that were born from my donor's eggs, because they're allowed to do more than one cycle. Obviously, a sperm donor can donate more sperm than an egg donor would. Is there such a
national organization?
Donors? Yeah.
So, but I know that a lot of the different cryobanks do have that available. And then I know parents who've kind of taken that into their own hands, and there's Facebook groups and that sort of thing about, you know, parents of this donor number. So that way those patients can kind of find each other.
So every donor is going to have a unique donor number, no matter where they're at in the country. So it's going to be, is it nationwide? Like there will be.
So I don't know if it's nationwide, but it's definitely like California Cryo. It's going to be the same donor number across the board.
Gotcha.
And so I've had patients who that donor had run out of sperm, but they still wanted more children, and were able to go through these types of channels to find somebody who had sperm that they weren't going to use. To procure to grow their family. So it's a really interesting community.
It is interesting. It's communities everywhere. Okay, so choosing a sperm donor. Now let's go to the different options for lesbian couples or single parents by choice and two egg providers. Let's talk about, it's good, I guess it's a combination of sitting down and deciding what's best depending on if there's one egg provider versus two, what the different options are. So you kind of got to sit around or the round table and talk about what's your family planning. How many children do you want to have? Do you have those kind of conversations? That's important too when planning.
Absolutely. That's almost always the first question I ask when I have an LGBTQ family together that's interested in growing their family is, in an ideal scenario, what does your family look like? Right.
Okay.
How many kids? Whose eggs? Whose uterus? Who's donating sperm? What, you know, do we have a known donors in mind? Those kinds of things. So they're all really important in the overall planning, because we're not just planning for this pregnancy, but to grow your family as a whole.
Right. So let's talk about one of the first options would be IUI.
Absolutely.
Right. So we don't have to go into the details of it, but if you have two egg providers in a couple or a single person by choice, single parent by choice, what would the IUI process look like?
So the IUI process is reserved for those patients who have both uterus and have ovaries, right? So we're going to be using both that person's uterus and ovaries to get them pregnant, to carry the pregnancy, deliver the pregnancy. And so the IUI would be using a sperm donor. We concentrate down the sperm. Everything goes in a really tiny, very flexible catheter. And so for the patient, it feels more like kind of a pap smear. So where we put the concentrated specimen inside the uterus at the time of ovulation.
And then when considering all the different ways, it's probably one of the cheaper forms, but you have to decide between if there's a couple, who would be the one that's using the eggs and the uterus, because it has to come from the same person, right?
Exactly.
So I'm sure there's a lot, you know, medical issues, anything else that might make one person an ideal candidate over the other, or it could just be a decision between the two of them, right? There's multiple things to consider, right? Okay. And then the next would be IVF with one of the partner's eggs. What would go over the special considerations or important considerations in that scenario?
So when it comes to IVF, again, we are asking the same questions, whose eggs and whose uterus, right? Because they don't necessarily have to be the same when it comes to IVF. We can do what's called reciprocal IVF, where we use partner A's eggs and partner B's uterus, so that both partners have a very involved component to growing their family. And so that's going to be something that is going to be a very personal decision between them. And then also what things we do from their evaluation perspective and their medical clearance and that sort of thing that would make maybe one partner a better choice over the other.
And so is it more common that you're seeing, or is it more common now to do reciprocal IVF in those situations? What do you see?
I mean, I think it's kind of something that's always been available. I know I was fortunate enough to do my fertility training in Southern California, so I may have had a very different perspective from the get-go. So I feel like it's definitely an option and something I bring up with all of my female couples.
But do you think most people come in thinking that it's going to be the one person that does the IVF just solo, and then you're like, well, you know, you could do this, and they're kind of like, huh.
I think it's actually gotten more common kind of out there in the community.
Okay.
That's something they're interested in. Unfortunately, I think there's probably more people who would want to do it, but then are unable to, secondary to cost.
Gotcha. So it would be an additional cost, right, to do it with the reciprocal with each individual contributing either the eggs or the uterus, right? Gotcha.
Well, I think it forces them into having to do IVF, where otherwise they may be really good candidates for, say, IUI.
IUI. Gotcha. Okay. Now, what about if you have a two egg providers and for whatever reason, donor eggs are used or needed? Was it that they may go into the process not anticipating that and find out eventually, or it could be something that's already known where they might need to use a donor egg? That is obviously quite a bit of an extra cost, but that can be done, correct?
Absolutely. I think you see it on both sides, right? So if you know there's already an issue with early menopause or diminished ovarian reserve, or if there's a medical issue in play that they don't want to use a particular person's eggs for whatever reason, or maybe there's been a failed IVF cycle or whatever that is, so they may come to me already having that idea in mind. But I think the other piece of it certainly is that a lot of kind of the LGBTQ community growing their families, they don't have a definition or a history of infertility because they haven't been exposed to attempting pregnancy to meet that definition. And so, in doing our evaluation, we may find other components in play that kind of push them into having that option, be something that they maybe weren't thinking about or planning on from the get-go.
Is that fairly common to find that some conditions that they may not realize they had just because they hadn't been planning to have kids before until they went to do something like IVF?
Absolutely. Infertility doesn't discriminate, right? So it affects 1 in 8 couples. It doesn't necessarily mean 1 in 8 heterosexual couples.
That's true. Okay, and then as far as gestational carrier, I'm sure there's, well, let's back up. We're talking about gestational carrier versus surrogate. What's the difference?
So from a technical perspective, even though the terms get used interchangeably often, a surrogate means the same uterus as eggs. So it's not something that we necessarily see a lot of in this day and age, largely because of the legal ramifications that you could imagine come from somebody being both the genetic parent and the carrier, that can definitely get into sticky situations at the time of delivery when it comes to really delineating parenthood.
So it's more common to, it's more appropriate, more common to use a gestational carrier where the person who is carrying the pregnancy doesn't have a genetic relation. It was
Correct.
neither the eggs that was not you that were not used. It's just the uterus that's being utilized, correct?
Correct.
And just I just wanted to bring this up because in any of the things we're talking about today, donor eggs, donor sperm, and or a gestational carrier may be used in what for whatever capacity. And there's obviously the capabilities there if that's needed, correct?
Absolutely.
Now, talk a little bit about the importance once you start, and I know this because I went through it as well with using donor eggs. The importance of the, I guess they're called reproductive attorneys now. They're being used and utilized by the fertility centers and the individuals or couples who are doing, is it called third party reproduction when you start getting out of the realm and using donor,
Right.
right?
Whenever you're using an additional person, that's going to be your third party reproduction. Absolutely.
Gotcha.
And yes, these reproductive attorneys are fantastic.
Yes.
There's three that I know off the top of my head that I work with very closely in the Dallas area. And I encourage all of my LGBTQ patients to start that process sooner rather than later because there's so much that can go wrong or be unanticipated early on. That's so much more than just adopting the child after so that both parents have equal rights.
And it's different from state to state and how that works, right?
Absolutely, unfortunately.
So having that person with the legal knowledge is crucial because they help with all of that aspect, not just the using the third party or using, it's different, determining parentage and then whether or not an adoption has to be done versus I think in some states it doesn't have to be a formal adoption, right? It just depends.
I'm not sure how it is in other states. I know in Texas, even if you're married, the person who does not have the genetic component to the child or deliver the child has to have an
Has
adoption
to.
process.
So what would be the situation then when I hear if you have a gay couple where they mix up the sperm, right? And they use the sperm. How does that work then?
So that's kind of become, I think, a bit of an urban legend, this idea of the
Is that?
swirl. So it's
Oh yeah,
not
okay.
really
Well,
something that we would do in the
you would do.
clinic. And you could
Okay.
imagine sort of the reasons for that largely being if there was an issue, we would need to know kind of who's going to be that genetic parent, or God forbid there was an issue with the baby or during development, right? If there was a genetic thing that came up, we'd want to know to be able to identify which dad may have kind of that going on in their gene pool. And then what we can do, especially when we're doing, say, IVF in those cases with an egg donor, we would split FERT. So of the eggs that were obtained from the donor, half would be partner A and half would be partner B's sperm. So there can be a mix from that IVF cycle, but we would have record as far as which
It's
embryos were transferred.
transfer, gotcha. Perfect. And we'll talk a little bit more of that because we're going into the second topic, which would be fertility treatment options for gay male couples, two sperm providers, and single parents by choice. As far as the treatment options, let's go back. So gay couples or two sperm providers who wish to build their families, they're going to need an egg donor and a gestational surrogate at the very least, right? And correct. Obviously IVF. Now we can go back and we don't have to touch on this in depth, but there may be where they might need a sperm donor as well, but potentially, but right. We definitely are going to need an egg donor and a gestational carrier. So if we talk about IV donor, egg plus gestational carrier, what's the typical process for that for a gay male couple or two sperm provider couple?
So typically we'd start with kind of procuring the egg donor side of things, because we'll be planning on making embryos and then cryopreserving them or freezing them. So mm-hmm. that way we can kind of do things in a stepwise fashion. So that way, once the embryos are frozen or cryopreserved, they seem to be good indefinitely. So there's no mm-hmm. rush on needing to get them into a uterus as quickly as possible or anything like that. So then that kind of helps sort of mitigate, I think, some of the stresses that come along with needing all of these things, as well as the financial burden that's associated mm-hmm. with each step of those. And then once we have the embryos created, then we can go down the road and procure the gestational carrier, make sure that they're a good candidate, get all the legal ironed out on that side of things, mm-hmm. and then be ready to transfer embryos.
So I know when I went through doing the donor egg, even, and this was almost 6 years ago, I can't believe my twins are almost five, but there was a lot available, but not as much as there are now as far as donor egg registries. And I'm sure there's a tons more of sperm donor registries, but do you feel like there's a limiting factor in this situation with a gay male couple, where is it more of a rate limiting factor, if you will, choosing the egg donor or the gestational carrier or both? And what's the availability of gestational carriers now?
Well, like you had mentioned before, and kind of what's available in donor options yeah. in general, right? It's going to be a matter of kind of how specific you want to be, right? If you're mm-hmm. looking for a very specific ethnicity, who's yes, a minimum yes. height with a, yes. you know, a rare hair color, whatever that yes. is, you're going to have a harder time finding gametes, yes. whether that's a donor sperm or donor egg, that meet all of those criteria. So I think if you have that broader sense, you probably have an easier time accessing donor gametes mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. as opposed to the gestational carrier. Obviously, being a gestational carrier is very involved, right, to put your whole body yeah. through a pregnancy and delivery. So I think that while there are agencies that kind of help assist with that, I feel like if anything, that tends to be more of an issue than mm-hmm. obtaining the donor eggs. So we yeah. kind of work with those in tandem, but mm-hmm. can separate them out from that financial perspective and the stress perspective.
And also similar to, again, with getting a donor egg, you could get eggs that have already been retrieved, correct?
Yep. Or so there are egg banks available.
Egg yep. banks. And then, or you could pick, I don't remember what the terminology is, but I picked the donor from the get-go and then went from there. So there's a difference.
Traditional donor egg okay. versus egg bank, right? Okay. Of traditional donors, there's kind of the ones you go through an agency or someone mm-hmm. who you know, right? So mm-hmm. a friend or family member who's offering to donate eggs. In either way, on the kind of the traditional side of things, you're essentially paying for that female to go through IVF in order to mm-hmm. access their eggs, mm-hmm. at which point they become yours to fertilize with your partner's yeah. sperm or donor sperm or whatever that looks like for you then to be the carrier, deliverer, and the intended parent. Obviously, they're gotcha. Your children. No one's going to take them right. away from you. Right. So that's kind of the option there, as opposed to an egg bank where yeah. they've basically done all that legwork and have yeah. the eggs frozen. Yeah. So once freezing eggs was no longer considered experimental, these egg banks sort of started popping up. So they've kind of already done that legwork, the eggs are frozen, but instead of, say, getting a cohort of maybe 20 or 30 eggs even from a traditional mm-hmm. donor, they're a business, right? So just mm-hmm. like a sperm donor, you're not getting the entire ejaculate specimen. They're mm-hmm. going to partition that off into different mm-hmm. vials for purchase. Mm-hmm. Same thing happens with egg banks. They're going to partition mm-hmm. those eggs off into cohorts of, say, 6 or 8 eggs that are mm-hmm. available for purchase.
And I'm sure you could purchase more than one if you wanted to and they were available, right?
You could. I would say the pro of an egg bank is its ease and its how fast it can be, right? The process okay. is already done. You just ship the eggs to your fertility center. They fertilize mm-hmm. them, make embryos, and those are then ready to go back inside the uterus. I would say if you're thinking about more than one child, it may be more cost efficient to go down the road of a traditional donor, especially if you want them all to be from the same genetic cohort.
That's very, very, very important point. And that's why I love having these conversations, because you just got to break it down, because there's so many things to consider, So having someone that could explain it just like Dr. Rakowski did, is so crucial because I consider myself pretty well versed in this. I've been through something similar, and there's still things that I'm amazed about or didn't even consider thinking about when going through these processes in different situations. So this is perfect. Now, you already touched on this, but we'll go over it again. IVF split cycle, donor egg plus gestational carrier. What is that?
So the split cycle will be something that we would use in the patients where we have two sperm sources, yes. Right? So whether that's a donor sperm and an intended parent sperm or whoever that mix happens to be, whether it's male-male couple, that when we procure the eggs, it's functionally kind of like doing what the egg banks do, right? So instead mm-hmm. of fertilizing all of the eggs that are obtained, we're able to kind of partition off, let's say there's 20 eggs from that donor. Mm-hmm. 10 eggs can be fertilized by partner A and 10 eggs can be fertilized by partner B. And so that way, hopefully we have embryos from each partner available mm-hmm. for transfer.
Interesting. And then you just, I guess it's up to the couple to decide which embryos to use first.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Okay. It's a very good breakdown. Now we're going to go into transgender family building. Okay. So the options are going to be split cycle IVF, as you just described, reciprocal IVF, traditional IVF, is it called traditional IVF?
Or I would say so.
Traditional IVF, and then IUI. So it's basically mm-hmm. going to depend on who would be an egg donor, sperm donor, depending on who the couple is, correct?
Correct. And what as their comfort what level is who's going to carry, is that not something that is palatable or, right. of interest, or is that something that's triggering and not, acceptable? And these are all conversations that we need to have, right? What is the degree of comfort, right? Even in a trans female who's still able to make sperm, that may not be something they're comfortable with. And so that's something that we need to address, kind of what is the main goal here? Is it parenthood? Is it the genetic linkage to parenthood? Kind of mm-hmm. what are you comfortable with in growing your family?
Okay, so if you have, for those individuals who are taking hormones, if you have a transgender person with eggs who's taking testosterone, what would be, and they come into your office wanting to plan family and talk about family building, what recommendations would you give that to that individual?
So in a trans man who's been taking testosterone and is no longer then having any kind of menstrual cycles or anything like that mm-hmm. and has not had bottom surgery, then we're going to have the discussion again about what kind of the degree of comfort is using their eggs something that they are comfortable with? And if so, then we talk about the process of doing that, the kind of hormonal stimulation that would be required in order to allow for growth of the eggs from those ovaries, in order to access those ovaries, to obtain those eggs. And if that's something that they're comfortable with, we can kind of plan that out.
And is there a certain period of time the maximum amount of time or the minimum amount of time they need to come off the testosterone before, going into this process?
It's going to depend how long they've been on it, what their baseline mm-hmm. labs look like, that kind of thing. Ideally, the best time would be prior to initiating gender-affirming hormone therapies, because mm-hmm. that way it's before the gonads have been exposed to these exogenous testosterone or other hormones. And so that way, if that's something that is doable at around the time where we're initiating transition, that would be the best time. I think it would be ideal then that those gametes haven't been exposed to these mm-hmm. exogenous hormones prior stimulation, because there's still just not a whole lot of data out there in regards to using gametes that have been exposed and then kind of stimulating mm-hmm. on the other end of the spectrum and kind of outcomes from that.
Right. So this is going to depend on how long they've been on, what their plans are, right? And what the levels are, right?
Absolutely.
If they've been taking testosterone, I guess you would need to follow the levels down to determine when would be the best time to start initiating the treatments, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So for a trans person with sperm who's taking estrogen, what considerations do you have or are needed for that individual?
So same thing, right? We're going to be talking about in those trans females who still potentially have the ability to make sperm, they haven't had bottom surgery. We're gonna talk about the degree of comfort level there, how we typically go about obtaining sperm, right? The cheapest and usually easiest way is through masturbation. So if that's not something mm-hmm. they're comfortable with, then we need to talk about more aggressive ways to obtain mm-hmm. sperm in these patients. And then with that too, the estrogen is gonna essentially function like a male birth control in that regard and kind of shut down sperm production. Yeah. And so that one's a little bit more tricky as far as the degree of kind of stopping the estrogen, as well as do we add in any other hormones to kind of stimulate the testes, and then stimulating the testes to make sperm, we're also going to be stimulating them to make testosterone. And so again, ideally the best time to do any kind of procurement of gametes in a trans person would be prior to the initiation of the gender affirming hormones. But it doesn't mean it can't be done. We have to talk about it, what that your comfort level is and kind of the timing and that sort of thing.
So for any individual who's listening to this, who is embarking on starting hormone therapy and hasn't quite done it yet, would you advise fertility preservation?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, and the reason why I bring this up is because most of the time those are younger individuals and they're not thinking about down the road. So what would you say to someone, you know, who's, you know, eager to get the therapy started? And I understand that.
Sure.
And maybe taking a pause to say, you know, you might be in your early 20s, mid 20s, and, you know, what about the future? You know, what would you, if you had them in front of you right now, how would you have that conversation with them about fertility preservation?
So one of the things that I usually just mention with anybody who's considering fertility preservation is that this is an investment in your future, right? So again, we're looking at the big picture. We're looking at growing your ideal family. We're not looking at kind of pregnancy as it comes, right? We're trying to plan ahead to make this sort of the smoothest, easiest, most effective way of doing things. And again, sometimes that requires doing things on the earlier side of things, even though you're not necessarily sure that you want children in the future, or that they need to be your own biologic children, or what that looks like. But you'd at least have that opportunity available, even if it's 10 years down the road. And then at that point, you don't necessarily have to take, you know, transition off of your hormone affirming therapies.
Right. I think it's important to know. And I hope that, and I'm sure, or I hope that at least when someone's starting to embark on this process for the hormone affirming therapies, that conversation is being had with them to consider fertility.
Unfortunately, it's not happening nearly as much as it should. It's very much kind of how the data is on cancer patients that still don't necessarily get all of that information at the time of their diagnosis and undergoing, you know, therapies that are going to be gonadotoxic and could negatively impact their future fertility. But I think it's something that, again, with raising awareness and having things like Pride Month where we're getting to have these conversations and be more candid and try to get the word out, that more people are going to be aware that these options exist. Earlier, we're seeing things like freezing of ovarian tissue or testicular tissue, even in those patients who haven't gone through puberty yet, because we know that getting those gender affirming therapies earlier prior to puberty are going to have better aesthetic effects overall. So I think there's a lot sort of going on that's, again, raising awareness for that. We're removing the experimental label on ovarian tissue freezing. I haven't seen that be removed yet on the testicular tissue, but you know, science is always advancing. So fingers crossed.
Well, I'm glad we're talking about this because it's something I think about too. With members, I have family members, and it's something that I'm kind of gingerly talking about. But you know, it's a hard thing to think about when you're young. And you want to get that next step going, and you're like, I'm not going to take the time out to, you know, freeze eggs or, you know, and it's just something I think it's very important that it needs to be discussed and more, like you said, more awareness needs to be made about it because it can definitely help things done when you're older and down the road that you don't have to do certain steps and you wouldn't have to stop your hormone affirming therapy. And it's very, very important to go ahead and consider that. Okay, so let's talk about for those individuals who are not taking hormones, who have not yet had bottom surgery. What are the options for those individuals who have eggs if they're prior to bottom surgery and while not taking testosterone? What options are there for family building as far as the different ART treatments?
So it's going to be a matter of whether or not they're comfortable, again, using their eggs and or their uterus, right? So if we're just planning on eggs, then we'd be looking at doing something like egg freezing or fertility preservation or IVF. In a way where we're either using reciprocal, where it's going to a partner's uterus, or like you said before, a gestational carrier, or what people tend to think of as a surrogate, as an option to carry the pregnancy there. So otherwise, if they're comfortable in using both their eggs and their uterus and delivering the baby, then an insemination or IUI is certainly an option in those patients.
And I just want to take a pause right here and just say that, you know, I think it could be kind of scary thinking about going into the process with a fertility specialist and all the technology that goes into it and all the nuances and the specific things. But one thing that I think that fertility specialists are so good at is trying to find out what you want. And they think about things before you even think about it. because that's their job, you know, not just the immediate time, but what about the future? And then trying to get you there in the most effective and cost-effective way. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes fertility specialists get a bad rap that they're just going to, everybody that can have IUI gets IUI, I'm sorry, IVF gets IVF. And that's simply not true. And I think that anyone that's listening to this, whether they're in the process themselves or may have a child that is transgender and you're thinking about the future, having a conversation with someone like Dr. Makowski about all the things to consider is so important when it comes to family planning and reproduction and preserving fertility. A general OBGYN is not going to be, I'm sorry, they're not going to be able to have these conversations with you. And I don't mean any disrespect to general OBGYNs, but they're simply not. These are the professionals, these are the experts where you want to get that information from, even if it's just for a talk, a chat, a consult about the future. It's very, very important to do that. Would you agree? And I'm not trying to disrespect general OBGYNs, but I think sometimes people think that they can talk about this stuff, but that's not where you want to get this type of information from, right?
Absolutely. And yeah. I think one of the big things to remember too is just like you're double board certified in mm-hmm. maternal fetal and OBGYN, yeah. we, the reproductive specialists, are also yeah. double board certified yeah. in RAI and OBGYN. So we have all of right. that information that you're going to get from your generalist. But we are slotted to have yeah. the time to sit down to talk with you if yes. it's an hour to go over yes. these things, right? Go over the different options. Like I said, my yes. almost first question to every LGBTQ mm-hmm. couple that comes my way is, what does your ideal family look like, right? Whose eggs? Whose uterus? Are we using mm-hmm. the same sperm donor for all the pregnancies? What is yes. that? Or same egg donor? What does that look like, right? So, and it's sometimes mm-hmm. they just haven't thought that far ahead or haven't realized that you have that many options. So yeah, we want to yeah. look at all of that and make sure that you choose what's best for your family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's never too soon to get that information and have that conversation. You may not be willing or needing to act on it now, but mm-hmm. being informed just empowers you once you get to the point that you are ready.
Absolutely.
So you might need to make special considerations along the way. So having the conversation sooner than later is ideal. So back to where we were before I digressed a little bit. Individuals with sperm, there are options prior to bottom surgery and while not taking options as far, sorry, while not taking estrogen, what mm-hmm. are their potential options for fertility treatments? Or
so if they're comfortable providing a masturbatory specimen, then mm-hmm. ideally we would like to bank that, if not several, because that allows them for insemination options in the future. If that's not mm-hmm. something they're comfortable with, there are surgical extraction techniques, but that's going to limit the number of sperm we have and kind of force mm-hmm. the female partner's side of things to have IVF in order to use that sperm in the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay, gotcha. Okay, and we already talked about fertility preservation for transgender individuals. Again, I kind of jumped up to the top with that topic there, but you know, that's also a very important point. We talked about what to look for and to choosing the right fertility center for you. What other things, would you say, as someone who does this is your job, you see this all the time, what other things do these individuals need to know when considering family planning, family building, fertility preservation, anything else?
So one of the things we didn't touch on would be mm-hmm. an option for those female patients considering reciprocal IVF would be something called InvoCell. So it's the only
yes,
treatment
talk
out
about
there
that
you're
yes,
allowed
yes,
to carry the same pregnancy. And so yes, what that is it's still IVF where we're using one person's eggs. However, we're going to still use the same person's uterus in most cases, but the other partner gets to carry the pregnancy in this champagne cork looking thing. So mm-hmm. this is the InvoCell device. And so what this allows for is there's an inner chamber where eggs, sperm, and enough media go to allow mm-hmm. for the development of embryos and their growth for 5 days. So instead of everything happening in a petri dish in the lab in an incubator, mm-hmm. it's happening in here. And the other partner gets to be the incubator, right? So mm-hmm. fertilization is happening in their body. The initial growth of the embryos is happening in their body. And at the end mm-hmm. of the 5 day mark, we take the device out, account for everything that we had from the get-go, and then put those embryos back in the original partner's uterus. So
interesting.
Very
it's for
neat
5 days.
Concept. It is for 5 days.
So mm-hmm. when you're comparing that to IVF, like you mentioned, you touched on instead of happening in the petri dish in a lab. So does that help with the cost?
It does. It brings it down about half. Now, granted, the success rate isn't quite as high as traditional IVF okay. because we now know things like, for one, there's a space limit, right? With traditional mm-hmm. IVF, we just keep taking petri dishes until we run out of eggs. So there is a limit on what we can put in this device. Also, we're planning on then doing a fresh embryo transfer, which we know now has lower chances mm-hmm. of success compared to frozen. But you do have the availability of any leftover or additional embryos that are made through the in vivo cell device to freeze those so that you have that then as an option for future pregnancies. So if maybe you were considering reciprocal IVF the next go around, well, those embryos are already made. And so those they can then go into the other partner's uterus who was carrying the device the first go around. So there's just so many different ways to do this.
And how many eggs do you typically put in the in vivo cell?
It's going to depend on clinic because the limits set by the FDA for the device and what clinics are actually doing is a little bit different.
Okay. So you just need to talk to the individual clinic to find out what's best for you. Okay. Correct. Anything else that you, I had it on my list to talk about the in vivo cell and I completely forgot. So I'm so glad you brought that up. We talked about
I made sure to bring it with me to the OR today. I was like, I know we're going to talk about it.
We're going to talk about it. And then I didn't bring it up, but yeah, okay. We talked about this last time and I had read about it and then I was so confused. I was like, I'm going to ask Sarah what this is. So
we touched on a lot of great things. I think the biggest thing, like you said, is finding someone who you're comfortable with and initiating the conversation, right? Yeah. It's never too soon. I'm not going to be pressuring you to do anything. Again, this isn't my family we're growing your family, right? Yeah. So I'm going to do what you're comfortable with.
Yeah, let's go through and see if there's any questions that were asked along the way. Let's see. I know there was something. A bunch of people saying they know you. We use Dr. Bukowski and we're able to try both ways for IVF. Watching this with my wife and our IVF baby, Lawson, on my lap. Dr. Bukowski is amazing. Brooklyn says hi, Dr. Bukowski. My adoption hearing from a pretty boy was today, so congratulations at pretty boy. Yay. I'm about to try IUI for the fourth time, no fertility issues. At what point should I consider IVF or pass the baton to my wife?
I think that's an excellent question. So obviously without having all of the information for both you and your wife, it's kind of hard to answer that. Typically when I have female-female couples, I like to do the evaluation in both simultaneously, just because you never know if something's going to come up that would change your mind. Yeah. And I have seen it happen. So it's not like I'm doing it just because I want you to go through a bunch of testing. So there's that component to it. And the other thing that we had kind of touched on before, right, is that infertility is still going to affect the LGBT community in that same 1 in 8 rate that we would expect it to in heterosexual couples. So after having 4 failed IUIs, is depending on kind of what's been going on before that, you still don't technically meet the definition of infertile until you've had 12 failed cycles where you've been exposed to sperm if you're under the age of 35 or 6 cycles if you're 35 or older. But obviously, $1,000 per pop for just the sperm on IUI adds up really quickly. So that's typically after a couple of cycles of IUI where I sit down, we kind of have that in vivo cell discussion of, hey, is it maybe something that we want to pursue here in the hopes, too, that we have maybe extra embryos frozen from that same sperm specimen for the future? Because that's kind of the in-between on the cost between IUI and really jumping into full-blown IVF.
Mm-hmm. And with the in vivo cell, for the ones that don't go immediately into the chamber, can any of those embryos be genetically tested if needed?
They could be, but at that point you kind of end up, it becomes cost prohibitive. At that point you might as well just do everything in the dish in the first place because you're going to want to grow them out for another day or so and then do the biopsy and so you're already utilizing.
So in vivo cells that really, doesn't really lend itself to PGT or PGS testing or screening for the genetics of the embryo. So that's more
it could be done, but like I said, from a cost perspective, cost prohibitive, just like fertilizing one egg at a time, right?
Gotcha. Not really, but you could obviously do that if needed for
absolutely
involving IVF, right? Right.
100%.
Gotcha. Okay. And everybody likes this conversation. Okay. Well, that's all the conversation or all the questions I have. Thank you so much for your time. As always, this is these are great topics to discuss, especially in June because this is Pride Month. So we wanted to show our support as allies and educate. Please share this information with anybody that you think might need to hear it. If you guys have additional questions, you can comment on the comments under this video when I post it on my Instagram feed, and we'll send it to anything that I can't answer. I'll send on to Dr. Bukowski to get an answer for you. So enjoy the rest of your day. Are you done in the OR or you still have more OR cases?
I am, but I was just trying to get out of there. Just, you know how it goes.
I know how it goes. All right. Well, thank you so much, Sarah, and have a great rest of your week.
Thanks. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed that discussion. Now tune in for the next episode on melanoma and other skin cancers.